We're just about to release a major, major upgrade, which enables royalties on the secondary sale of physical items, which is something that some of the, you know, the big brands and some of the big sort of fashion magazines have been kind of clamoring for. It's taken us a while to get to it.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. What is up, everyone? I'm your host, Charlie Schrem, and you are listening and watching another epic episode of The Charlie Schrem Show, where together you and I, twice a week, for a very long time, you get to dive deep with some of Bitcoin and crypto's most influential leaders, true amazing projects, companies that are building out trailblazing for a long time now. And we get to like talk to them and hear stories. We get to understand the significances, the differences. We get to understand where the market is right now, potentially where it's going in the future. I know a lot of us are investors ourselves, or just people that are listening. So thank you again, 2024, for constantly listening and for being here. But I'm excited. We're diving deep into a conversation today with Justin Bannon, the co-founder of the Boson Protocol. And we're embarking on this journey. Justin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be here, Charlie.
You have a significant track record in technology entrepreneurship. You worked in various sectors, have been involved in venture building, scaling tech startups yourself. You come from having a lot of expertise in different blockchain projects. And you guys launched the Boson Protocol a couple of years ago. And you've kind of like taken one aspect of what blockchains and smart contracts can do. And you've kind of like taken that and that's been your lane. And that's kind of been like verification of assets and automating digital to physical redemptions of different goods and kind of like that supply chain, which has been a huge narrative now in the Bitcoin and crypto world in the last year. How do you feel about that, having launched before this narrative has been, what are they calling it, DPIN now?
Well, I think it's this kind of real world asset. I mean, DPIN is, it's decentralized physical infrastructure networks, kind of overlay this, yeah. But I mean, I started getting involved in digitally representing physical products and services when I used to work for and ended up sort of heading up a kind of Web2 platform. One of the brands was like Priority Pass, which basically creates vouchers for airport lounge visits and meals and
I was a member.
Yeah. So when I joined there, that, you know, they were like about a $50 million company and everything was paper. And I did a master's in digital and did a digital transformation of them and moved a lot of what they did to like digital vouchers. And that was right, really successful with this whole kind of move to mobile, and all the banks were buying digital vouchers, and ended up scaling that platform into like a $1 billion revenue platform. And so that's how I kind of got into this notion of representing physical things in a digital way. And then, I mean, I've always been a bit geeky, so whilst kind of working there, I did this second master's pretty early in blockchain. And I thought, okay, well, I've kind of taken this concept from paper to kind of digital. What happens if you were to take it to blockchain? And so, yeah, I mean, with blockchain, you get some, I mean, you can just move the whole thing to blockchain and just have this kind of trusted IOU. I mean, I could write an IOU now saying, here, Charlie, buy this IOU for me for $10,000 and you can redeem it for my car, right?
Yeah.
Do that on paper. I could do a little digital, I could send you a little text, but none of these things would be strong commitments. None of these things would be enforceable. So the difference that you should have when you move to a blockchain is, if I now write this IOU to you using, you know, blockchain technology, it should be a strong commitment that I can't renege on, right? So, I mean, it's very, very easy to just, I don't know, create a little NFT and say, I owe you this, but there's no enforcement mechanism.
Yeah, because you're still relying on the issuer of that kind of receipt. And there's a company out there, I forget what it's called. I'm literally dropping its name. I'll put it in the edit. But basically, you can send them your crypto memorabilia, your Rolex watches, any high value priced item that's like has a price that's trackable. They can issue some sort of NFT for you against that item. And then you can supposedly, because they have, I don't know how far they've gotten. There's a bunch of companies that are trying to do this now, like similar to like what you guys, but then you can like borrow against them and things like that. But I still have to trust that issue. The first thing I'm doing is who's this LLC? Who's behind it? You know, like, where are they keeping this stuff? There's all this work that you have to do. And so at that point, is it worth it? So how do you remove that problem?
And so that, you know, there are kind of, this is the fundamental problem. I mean, some people refer to it as this kind of physical asset oracle problem, which is, if I tokenize my car and you buy the token, how do you know that you're going to get the car? And that's the fundamental problem, I mean, that Boson solves. So it, Boson solves it by locking up the money into a protocol, issuing an NFT, and then only paying the seller if the transaction is successful. And so it, it does that by, you know, in a pretty efficient way. But, you know, it, it does rely on the fact that funds get locked up. And then the buyer has a period of time where they can dispute or raise. And so these are what we call kind of like optimistic protocols, which are really efficient. I mean, like Amazon and eBay are optimistic, right? It, it sends you, they will send you goods, and then any disputes happen after the fact.
You've baked in rules, but what's cool about it is that it made it hyper efficient for what you're trying to do. Instead of like just launching a blockchain with baked in rules and some governance and this is what we're going to do. Like, and you also just announced like a really big company that's going to be doing high verification of luxury assets as well.
Yeah. I mean, and this came because, I mean, in parallel to kind of launching and scaling Boson, I've also continued that sort of academic thread. I recently published an academic paper with the Professor Jason Potts, the blockchain economist.
Oh, nice.
Which is all about this notion that that blockchain technology is not just another incremental technology. It's a technology on the scale of like language or writing, where like, you know, it's this.
You're the second person who's made that case to me in the last month.
Yeah.
You're the second person who's compared this technology at the scale of like language and fire and things like that, like fundamental changes in.
Because, you know, like you think, you know, these are what we call institutional technologies and they help us coordinate. So language was essential to forming the first sort of societies. And then, you know, writing was essential for forming the first sort of civilizations, which were at a different scale. And, you know, blockchains are a way of robustly, securely organizing things without the need. I mean, if you think, you know, what Boson does is it replaces intermediaries that monopolize and extract, but it also enables commerce to happen in a way that's like computable, right? You can program it, and you know it doesn't rely on recourse from courts and arbitrary institutions and stuff. You know, the funds are locked up, and either the transaction executes to agreement or it reverts. So you get these different properties that we call computable, because you know, computers reliably take inputs and process them to produce outputs. Whereas the current economy, even though it's sort of digitized, it's still pretty fuzzy, right? I mean, you could still maybe get away with screwing someone over with commerce, and maybe you could, you know, and then, you know, are they going to bother taking you to court? And did it? But, you know, with blockchains, we can make that enforcement automatic, and we can really tighten things so that we get this thing called a computable economy. So that's the sort of research I've been doing. And as part of that, you know, what we're saying, though, is if you're going to get this new, totally new type of economic order called a computable economy that's can lift us from, you know, this digital post-industrial economy into some new, far more efficient, effective economic order, well, for that to happen, you can't just have a subset of assets that have got these properties, like, you know, all the on-chain assets and stuff like that. You have to be able to compute all assets. So this bridge between on-chain mechanisms and off-chain asset becomes absolutely critical. And with Boson, we built a major, what we kind of call this base layer for enabling this tokenization and exchange.
I understand how you could represent like a transaction of a car, but do you have the mechanisms for, like, you know, a venture capital fund, or like where there's different levels of partners and you have to, like, or like a film financing fund where you have a waterfall and different people get paid when certain triggers are hit and things like that? I mean, it's very complex type of rules that smart contracts can kind of handle, but they have to be worked out.
Yeah, well, the two examples that you just sort of raised there, they're actually simple.
Okay.
because all of those sort of transactions can just be moved natively on chain. I mean, you know, blockchains compute and exchange value natively. So it's perfectly possible. Like if you think about,
yeah, so if we're you think talking about these, when the real asset comes into play and it needs to enter an onboarding process that allows that physical asset to get converted into a smart representation.
Well, where's the physical asset in your example?
I don't know. I'm asking you that.
Because in your example, the any shares, any stocks,
that's
any
easy. You're right. That's
all of
an
that
easy
should
one.
Natively, that shouldn't be paper share certificates. That should just be stored on an on-chain ledger.
You're right. That's a bad example. Yeah. So like, what about something that's like can't be nailed down? So a house is easy also because it's not moving, but a car
is
potentially...
of all the physical assets is the easiest because you don't have a challenge with, it doesn't need
the
to
issuing.
Be kind of custodied per se, because it's not typically it's not moving anywhere.
What about jewelry
and
precious
so
metals?
We,
like
we divide it into like these kind of physical assets, which are assets that cannot be natively represented on chain, right? So stocks, shares, T-bills, all of these things, eventually the best place for them is to be originated on an on-chain ledger.
Anything that's already digital, though.
And it's already digital and fully on-chain, right? So or a lot of the real-world asset tokenization that you see in these areas is really it's really just the fact that they're not natively on-chain at the moment. So we're going to plug them in, but eventually they'll just be on chain. There'll be no need for tokenization of things that are already on chain.
What do you think then needs the most representation on chain then?
Well, the things that cannot natively be represented on chain that require these bridging technologies that we're really focused on are things that have inherently physical attributes, such as collectibles, high-value commerce assets, commodities, precious metals, art.
Art is a good one, good point.
All of these sort of things, physical art, all of these things have an inherently physical thing that is not going to be dissolved and represented in a purely digital way. And so in order for this computable economy to come about, where we get all these amazing properties of programmability and super high liquidity, low transaction costs and stuff, what we need is a way to represent these physical assets on chain in a way that mimics the same properties as sort of on-chain assets. And if you remember beginning of last year where we had all of these kind of defaults in crypto.
Yep.
The debts that were getting paid were the on-chain debts, like, you know, people, you know, topping up their vaults in Maker and stuff.
Yeah.
Because there was no discussion or negotiation. You know, if you got liquidated, you got liquidated, right? Whereas with off-chain stuff, you could renegotiate and reschedule. And so, you know, it's that.
So you want to bake in that, like, renegotiating a reschedule. You already did into that process. And I like that a lot because, like you said, like there are definitely occasions when you know things can be worked out. So that's a very unique.
Yeah.
I would so I guess bankruptcy could be potentially a good thing you could see on chain too, where you have a mixture of like on and off chain type of debt and things like that you need to have representation of. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and all of these things can be worked out, you know, you can just have a pattern, a template and apply it, right? But the really interesting thing that we did sort of as part of this research is that we identified that there were these two categories of these physical real world assets. And it's kind of like a 2x2, which says, you know, what's their verification requirement, right? Because for the vast majority of commerce that you'll get through Amazon and eBay, it's this optimistic, efficient model where we just send it in the post.
Yep.
Any problems we'll deal with after the fact, right? But we all know intuitively that there's another class of physical assets where you wouldn't do that, right? You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that with a Rolex. You wouldn't do that with, you know, maybe even a piece of art unless it was from a trusted. But, you know, there's a whole load of items where, you know, it would be dangerous to receive it because you could get sent a fake and then you have to dispute that. And it would be just dangerous to sell it because send it because you could, you know, oh, I didn't receive it, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
And so there is a model for handling that, but it's a more trusted model, right? And that model is, instead of seller sending the asset to the buyer, the seller sends that asset to a trusted third party who is like a verifier slash custodian, right? Now, to be honest, initially, you know, we come up with this and we kind of see this from a theoretical perspective. Yeah, I mean, my instinct is to be quite resistant of this because Boson is such a decentralized solution. One of the other things we discovered is what there's a fundamental challenge with kind of using things like crypto economics to tokenize, which is if you have to lock up funds, that's massively inefficient from a capital point of view, right? So if you're hold on the seller, you know, to make that seller, you know, behave in accordance with the agreement, is holding those funds. Well, the moment you pay the seller, you don't have that hold. And if you want to tokenize something for a long period of time, that's super capital inefficient. And particularly with high value items and in like the finance industry, you know, holding on to capital for months and months is just not an option. So there's this kind of inherent trade-off between having trust minimization, where you lock up funds within a crypto economic system, and, you know, having capital efficiency, but then you have to trust someone, right? And so you can kind of carve up these real world assets into two classes. One that's sort of assets that can be handled by Boson really efficiently in a trust minimized way. And then this other class of assets, for the sake of the buyer and the seller, you really do need a trusted third party to verify it and then also potentially custody.
Yeah, you do.
And then issue. And so, like I said, it's, you know, not, wasn't initially the findings that we wanted. We'd love to have found a way of having super trust minimized and super verified. But there's a straight trade-off there. Yeah, I mean, we just saw this opportunity then to build a second protocol that would cover this second part of this landscape.
Ah.
And that's the you know, the idea of Fermion was sort of born. So Fermion is a protocol for tokenizing and exchanging physical assets, but in a verified way. So whereas Boson is fully everything on-chain, trust minimized, Fermion uses, you know, on-chain protocol to mediate between a seller who will then, instead of sending the physical asset to a buyer, will send it to a trusted verifier and then a custodian, and then an NFT gets issued. And because these are usually more high value assets as well, we're leveraging these emerging fractional NFT standard as well. So these then plug straight into DeFi for price discovery and liquidity, which I think is going to be enormous.
Having those custodians is very important to be able to have those high value items be able to be brought onto the chain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now what's your focus for 2024?
For Boson, and one of the things I should say is that Boson, I mean, they're separate protocols, but Boson is like the first stage. So, you know, all the tokenization, the first stage happens in Boson. And then optionally, you can add this second stage of verification with Fermion.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So with Boson, you know, we during the bear market, we built out the whole core.
Yeah.
Got a whole suite of applications enabling anyone to tokenize physical assets as these redeemable NFTs. We're just about to release a major, major upgrade, which enables royalties on the secondary sale of physical items.
Oh, very cool.
Which is something that some of the, you know, the big brands and some of the big sort of fashion magazines have been kind of clamoring for. It's taken us a while to get to it. But essentially, I mean, Boson provides, because you've got this persistent problem of rug pulls, if you know, if you buy an NFT from me for, like, you know, I don't know, some sort of piece of art, let's say, and then you were to go and resell that for a higher price and you get paid, you know, more, if I don't deliver it to the final buyer, even though Boson holds the initial price, you know, the final buyer could have paid a lot more, and so can still subject to this sort of partial rug pull.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
So you could have bought it for like $100 and then put $100 in the protocol. So the protocol has got this as security as $100. Yeah. But then the next guy could have bought it off of you for like $300. So they've spent $300, given that to you. The protocol's only got $100. So if the seller doesn't deliver, they're $200 down, right? So we have this feature now called sequential commit, where instead of selling it on OpenSea or between you, each buyer just puts the money into the protocol. And the protocol makes sure that in the event...
I like this idea a lot. Yeah. It's like a surety bond in a way.
It is. It is. So it ensures that...
That's very cool.
If the seller gets... If the seller defaults, then everybody gets paid what they should. Plus, it also means that buyer one doesn't have to wait until buyer seven redeems.
Yeah.
You get a portion of the pot that you're entitled to, like with optimal efficiency. So you might get that first $100 you'll get, but only when the sale completes will you get like the remainder of it. But because this provides this strong incentive for all buyers to buy from within the protocol in order to prevent this kind of partial rug pull, it also means then that we can charge royalties on each one of these secondary sales.
Yes, you can.
Strong incentive to do the sales in the protocol.
The economics incentivize people to do the sale in the protocol too.
Yeah.
So it works out.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Therefore, we get the, which is a real kind of holy grail, is royalties on secondary sales of physical items, all using kind of crypto economics, which, for the kind of geeks among us is really cool. But the thing is, it's a real massively demanded feature in sort of fashion and luxury to be able to do this. So we're really looking forward to roll that out.
Congratulations.
And then a whole host, with Boson, we've got a whole host of like advanced digital support, plugging into, all of these widgets into different websites. We've just launched with WooCommerce, the kind of biggest e-commerce platform.
Yeah, congratulations. It's amazing.
A big strategic partnership and integration with them. So, Boson is like, the base layers are fully mature and it's all about product market fit and connecting to mass adoption. Then with Fermion, we're launching Fermion mid-year as this sort of separate protocol, but this second this verification layer sitting on top of Boson. So it's kind of, Boson is still this base layer that ingests the physical assets, and then it goes up to the second layer with Fermion. We will start in the collectibles market, but Fermion is really like a toolkit. I mean, if you think about things like Wix and that are for websites. I've spoken to loads of founders. There's one guy that's doing like luxury tequila and wants to tokenize that. And he's sort of like building a protocol for that, right? And then there's another guy that's doing property token, and he's been in property 30 years and he's building a protocol. These people should not be building protocols, right? So no. Fermion is this toolkit that they can just pick up. If you want to tokenize Bonsai, right? You can just come to Fermion, you can plug your custodians and verifiers and sellers in, and you can, out of the box, create a tokenization protocol. And we, with our kind of protocol designers and engineers, let us handle that hard tech, and then other people can just kind of do tokenize various classes of assets.
I love that. I'm really impressed by what you guys have been building, especially trucking it through all these years and launching really cool features that really people need. Really appreciate that, because there's a lot of stupidity out in the industry today. There's also a lot of amazing things, but it's good to see some, I really like talking to more of the OG projects that kind of been through that bear market. They need to give a badge. But that's all the time we have today, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have a phenomenal guest. His name is Sungmin Cho. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah. Hey, nice to meet you. I'm really proud and glad to be in the show.
It's so cool when people come on and they tell me they're proud. What you've done and what you've built and some of the things that you have going on are just so phenomenal by like giving a reason for your company to exist. But you're also a prime example of why this technology should exist. And you've been building out some really cool things. And I'm excited to kind of talk about all the different things. Let me give a little bit of background. You're the CEO of, it's pronounced Beeple?
Yes, it's the upside down of people.
Ah, it's the upside down of people. So it's spelled B-E-O-B-L-E. and it's exactly. people upside down. When you look at it, oh, that's great. Now that you've said that, I'm never going to forget that. How did you come up with that name?
So I was like trying to decide our name. And we were in the three founders just talking about the name for like 5 hours. And then I just opened up the PowerPoint and then I typed people. And I just tried out like doing a like flip, vertical flip. And I just realized, oh, this looks feeble. That's how we got into this name. Yeah. It kind of represents like people inside like the digital world. Yeah.
You're going after combining the Web3 social platform, the wallet, which we're all kind of like familiar with using, but you kind of like have been gamifying it by creating these like features where you earn if you follow, you discover, there's a rewards-based model, the amount of chats that you're putting out, and there's a relationship there. You have a background in both. You were the CEO and founder of Mad Boy Games, and then you also had roles at traditional finance companies like Goldman Sachs and Citadel. So, I mean, how do you like build that master document about how things will run? Like there must be some sort of architecture in your head about the way you see this thing kind of scaling and, you know, kind of give us that vision.
Sure, sure. So, yeah, like I was doing my own game studio. That was like 2014. I ran it for like 2 years, and that's when I started to gain, like in general, like knowledge about startup, like how to run it. It was like my first startup. So that's where I learned those kind of things. And eventually when I got into traditional finance, I was one of the quant dev tweaking the like algorithms and execution. And some of the executions, they like happen really fast with like massive volume, which is very similar to how chats work. So chats are very different from any other architectures or software piece in the sense that it has the highest transaction volume. Like imagine how often you send the money to someone, like compared to how many chats you send to your friends every day. So in terms of the volume wise, chats aren't like cannot be compared to any other like software kind of piece. So that's where my experience from those traditional finance where massive amount of transactions flow down to the exchanges and the banks where I was like handling those, trying to tune the performance. Those kind of things really benefited. Like I benefited from those experience for building Beeble. So Beeble itself obviously is a chat protocol and an infrastructure and also the app for delivering a chat from wallet to wallet. And we were expecting a lot of volumes may flow down once we become popular. So that's where how we like started like designing in a way that it can scale, but at the same time, secure and decentralized. Yeah.
You've attracted over 150,000 users and a big following, but I'm still not convinced because one of the most popular apps that's not crypto, well, now it's a crypto app too, is Venmo. And Venmo kind of launched as this like social app in a way. But I almost every payment I do, I hit that private button because do we want our friends to know the payments that we're making?
So yeah, I do like fully understand your concern. On the other hand, I think a little differently because in Venmo, you know that this guy is your friend, right? So it's like you're disclosing your wallet address to me, like because we know each other in Web 2. Like, I mean, actually, what we are talking here right now is a Web 2 world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know each other. I'm a CEO of Beeble. That's not like Web 3 itself. It's more like a LinkedIn profile, right? It's like a Web 2 profile that we know physically each other. So that's where it will be a little like not really comfortable to share like your financial things to me. But if you assume that the pure Web 3 world is your identity becoming the wallet itself, then I know your financial transactions through your wallet, but I don't know that it's you, right? I mean, I have no idea with your Web 2 identity. So that's where it becomes different. It's more like the easiest comparison I'll say is I have a bunch of Steam friends I play like Dota or like other like games with, but I don't really know who they are. I just met them in the game and I just play the game together. And I do assume they are my social graph in Steam. I mean, they're my social network inside Steam, but that's a totally separate world with my Telegram or other messengers like Instagram, right? I just know them for the games. So that's what we more think Web3 social graph or Web3 social would eventually be. It should be like a pure portion that you interact purely with the Web3 people for the Web3 purposes. Yeah.
I see what you mean. There's already a huge amount of value that's been added to individual wallets that have been around the industry a long time, that have been doing things where you kind of don't really know who they are. And yep. slowly IDs, you know, who you are on this Web2, Web3 transition, it's less about like your name, where you're from, what school you went to, where you worked, kind of like these things that exist on like the traditional CV, but rather all those things will exist as your web wallet identity somehow, and people will judge you based on your actions inside of that wallet. And to further that, I agree with you. At our fund, Druid Ventures, we've invested in a company called Meta Intro, and she's been essentially like your Web3 resume wallet. And so, you know, eventually something like that would connect with yours, and it would further that where you wouldn't need actually CV because it'd be work. And then maybe down the road, your college or high school diplomas could be based inside the wallet too. So what you're saying is like there's this transition, and down the road, it's going to be the complete opposite, where the only way people will judge us is based on the type of transactions that we have. And it's not just financial transactions. It could be chat transactions. It could be anything.
Exactly. I mean, I do think in some sense, like Web2 and Web3, they will coexist. I don't think like 100% of the Web2 things will like purely move on to Web3. I don't really think that way. But what I strongly do think is there will be a very strong need for the pure Web3 portion as the Web3 industry grows. And people might be wearing multiple masks, right? I mean, I have a Web2 mask of like being a CEO of Beeble and doing this and doing that. But I might have like a separate Web3 mask that doesn't really link to my Web2 one, but it does like, does this transaction, that transaction, which leads to like a bit different personality. Yeah. So yeah,
look,
that's
it's
what I think.
That, right, what you're describing, so I agree with you. My worry is that we're still a far away from that transition. It's not happening fast, but then companies like you and people like you are helping this transition happen faster than we're seeing like hardware devices. But what you're talking about is really how Bitcoin and crypto got started. Because if you remember, like the early days of Bitcoin, we were just congregating in IRC chat rooms or on chat forums. And everyone was like, Charlie, didn't you think Satoshi Nakamoto was a fake name? But you have to understand, not one person, except for maybe Hal Finney, used their real name in the chat forums, in the original Bitcoin chat rooms and chat and all the different original Bitcoin places. Every single person was behind their own, myself included. I was Yankee. And that name was given to me in my old like kind of hacker communities because I was the only American in the group. And so in the early Bitcoin community, I was always Yankee. And then when we actually launched our company, BitInstant, we were BitInstant. We were never our names. And I met my co-founder, Gareth Nelson, in the UK. We ran a company, a business together for 3 years, successful. I never met him in person, even now.
Yep.
Because that's that type of community that I think you and I like kind of were growing into. And so you're seeing it more and more and more. How do you think it's changed since like the early days? Like what's going on inside the application now? What are you seeing in terms of like the way people act and react?
I think it's more about, I mean, the way that act and react, I think it stays the same. I think it's more a matter of the content. Right now, let's say like, if you imagine TG, like what do you talk about in TG? It's all about like alphas, what coins new, it's all like those. I do assume that's like a similar content. I mean, that's what we only talk about. We don't really talk about what we're going to have launch for in like TG, like alpha groups. Like maybe, but that's not the core purpose of it, right?
No, but those groups become like work only groups pretty much.
Exactly. I do think there will be more content in the Web3 chat rooms. Like what I do think is 100% missing right now is the chats for the games. I mean, in Web2, like let's say there's like an online game, like you cannot imagine a game without a chat box, right? Like what are those guys gonna like talk about? Like, I mean, what are guys those guys gonna do without a chat box? Let's say they have a guild inside a game and they don't have a chat, then what are they going to do, right? That's kind of weird. Maybe they would have Discord, but that's not really native for like people who just met, like formed a party or formed a group, right?
If you work...
no worries, go ahead, yeah.
If you work like fully remotely, and especially if you work in crypto or Web3, you have, you know, the term social media implies like fun and social and relaxation. So I don't even like to use that term anymore. These are our own personal circular economies. We connect all of our businesses and our tools and our people and our alpha and our information, and we create our own way of like making ourselves money, but also making all the other people around us money. And those other people also help you make money. And it becomes this kind of like great, but it's built in Web2 rails right now.
Yep. Yep. That's true. That's true. I think that's like because Web3 is not mass adoption yet. I think that's why, because it's still, I think like everyone in Web3 is still some way OG or like early adopters, I think. Like once like it really hits the mass adoption where like people outside general that I meet in the streets, they also do Web3, I think there should be much more content than just alpha groups and like NFT holders group, like holders community. I think there should be definitely something more. And when that portion comes in, there will be a huge demand for the chat because people have more things to talk about and they have to talk about it. So that's what I think. Like still Web3 is like early and it didn't hit the mass adoption. So people might think, well, like Web3 SocialFi projects in general, like where they're used for, like people would, some people would feel that way. But I think it's just yet the mass adoption hasn't hit. So there aren't many contents to talk about it, using your wallet and those kind of things. So yeah, that's what I think.
It's a really good point. I live in a small city, a small like county area. And so all the politicians are very accessible. So I was talking to one of the people who's involved in the elections, like he's supervisor of the elections here in where I live. And I was like trying to convince him. I said, imagine if every person had this like smart token in their wallet and you did all voting and referendums through that mechanism. And I was like, really felt like I was getting somewhere. I'm like, yeah, it's 2024. We understand this stuff now. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, imagine like just about your idea here. Let's say I voted to like someone, like a candidate, and then that transaction is in on-chain. And though like my wallet is anonymous, people won't be able to figure out that wallet belongs to me, but I still voted to this candidate A. And let's say in Beeble, we created like a token or like transaction gated chat for a chat room for everyone who voted for candidate A. Then that has some more contents than just like alpha groups, right? I mean, and it totally just makes sense. Like we just want to form a group and with like a proof that this guy actually voted in candidate A, like those kind of things, right?
So it's like a proof thing. It's not like an easiness of voting thing. We can still make the voting in person, but there's almost like a proof of voting. You know, why can't proof of voting be
exactly
a side company? Like, why does it have to be the government doing it? Why can't I start giving out these voting tokens to people? And when they go and vote, there's got to be a way to do this, not through the government, because I really...
Exactly.
I know. I actually know a friend of mine. She tried to launch a company, and I think it was too early. It was like 2012, called Clear Voter. She's from Clearwater, which is like a beach town. And she's like Clear Voter, which is a blockchain voting mechanism. But I mean, 2012. Now, her and her husband run this big Bitcoin Lightning company called Block Spaces, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But I would love to see Clear Voter become a thing again, because it was a great idea. I still think it's a great idea. I want to transition really quick before we run out of time and ask you, I noticed that a lot of my guests lately have been in Hong Kong, and I ignorantly thought that Hong Kong was kind of like, didn't want, you know, crypto companies or people to be working out of there. Can you dispel some of that for me? Like what's life like on the ground? Because I used to travel so much to Hong Kong up until like 2014, 2015, my favorite city in the world. And I want to go back.
Sure. So I think that changed very suddenly early last year. It was, I think like what I recall isn't like the 100% correct memory, but what I recall was there was like a massive government announcement back in March 2023 that they will be start working on making Hong Kong like a crypto hub of Asia. And they started like providing these licenses, like actual government approved licenses to all those exchanges. And they were forcing the banks to create, like they shouldn't refuse crypto companies from creating like bank accounts. So that was like,
what a 180 degree change.
Exactly. Yeah. So like that I also did like an interview with Bloomberg about that, like how like governments like change in their like stance, like affecting all those startups in Hong Kong. So I didn't really see that much impact early last year, right after it. But right now I actually do see like some people are actually coming back to Hong Kong to do their like crypto business. They have like government issued grants in Cyberport or those kind of places for
crypto companies. Do you have to be like a crypto exchange to get that license? Could like you go get it just to like have a relationship with the government? Because I think that's what a lot of people always wanted.
So like from our business, we don't really need a license, I'll say. So yeah. So I'll say for us, like it won't really be required something, but if I say, let's say I'm a decentralized exchange and I want to be like a legit company in Hong Kong, then definitely you can apply for it, I think.
Thank you for taking the time and coming on the show today. I really love it. And I'm excited to download your app and play around. I mean, best part about this show is I get to learn, find out, and meet amazing people. But like really, every day I get re-excited about things going on in our industry.
Yep.
I could be traveling all over the world and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year doing it, and I would never meet the same amount of people as I would doing the show. And same thing with the listeners. I mean,
exactly.
The thing is with the listeners is there's never been a more fulfilling job than doing a podcast. When you meet a listener in real life and they tell you they listen to the show or they email you, I was a kid that I couldn't get people to listen to me in school for 5 minutes. And I have people listening, sitting for 45 minutes. Listening to us talk about different topics. So humbling. Appreciate you, bro. Nice to meet you. Next time in Hong Kong, we're hanging out.
Yep, sure. It was my pleasure to be here. Thanks for your time.